Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Bill Delaney. Coming up, has the Israeli cabinet targeted Yasser Arafat for assassination?
The WTO abruptly calls off the Cancun meeting. What happens now?
And the head of the New York Stock Exchange defends his huge paycheck, set up by the very people he's regulating.
Also, the U.S. economy, according to Paul Krugman, something's got to give.
One of three things has to happen. We do in Argentina and actually go bankrupt. We roll back all of the Bush tax cuts and then some, or we drastically slash Social Security and Medicare.
And fact and fiction blur in HBO's K Street. Did James Carville put words into Howard Dean's mouth?
These stories coming up here and now.
The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. Hurricane Isabel is lumbering toward an expected close encounter with the eastern states later this week. Stacy Stewart is a meteorologist with the National Hurricane Center in Miami. He says the storm will have a wide impact.
The strongest winds are going to occur where the eye makes landfall, but this storm is so large, there's probably going to be tropical storm force winds that extend outward more than 300 miles from the center, especially to the east. So that means that even folks up in Long Island could receive tropical storm force winds if the storm makes landfall near the Outer Banks of North Carolina. If it moves further up the coast, they could have possibly near hurricane force winds over portions of New Jersey.
Stewart says Isabel currently has winds of 140 miles an hour. Home improvement stores are already seeing a run on items like plywood and batteries. Don Harrison is with Home Depot's Eastern Division.
Each of our stores is a warehouse in and of itself. So as the storm tracks north, we're pulling supplies out of our stores in Florida, for example. And those trucks are already on the road with generators, with plywood, gas cans, chainsaws, tarps, you name it.
Forecasters say it's still too early to tell, though, exactly where and when Isabel will make landfall. Fire broke out at a prison in the capital of Saudi Arabia today, killing 67 inmates. A Saudi official says 20 other inmates and three guards were injured. The cause of the blaze is still not known. At a ceremony in Iraq today, Secretary of State Colin Powell lit candles for victims of Saddam Hussein's chemical weapons attacks on Iraqi Kurds in the 1980s, and he told their families that such atrocities will never happen again. In Baghdad today, a U.S. soldier was killed by a rocket-propelled grenade, and American forces rounded up a number of Iraqis suspected of financing attacks on U.S. troops. A judge in India has convicted 13 men for burning to death an Australian missionary and his two young sons in 1999. Martha Ann Overland has the story.
Graham Stewart Staines was a missionary who had worked with leprosy patients in India for more than 30 years. He and his children, age 8 and 10, were asleep in their car outside of a church in a remote village in the eastern state of Orissa when a mob set their vehicle on fire. The killings were part of a wave of attacks against Christians accused of converting Hindus. Most of India was outraged by the murders, but tribal villagers defended the killings and hid the main suspect for a year before he was arrested. Staines' wife says she has forgiven her husband's killers. She and her surviving daughter have remained in India. The judge in the case that took 2.5 years to prosecute said he will sentence the men next week. All 13 face the death penalty. For NPR News, I'm Martha Ann Overland in New Delhi.
On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 20 points at 9,451. Trading has been light so far today. On the NASDAQ, the composite index is off 3 points at 1851. This is NPR News. In NPR's business update, stocks have edged lower in morning trading on Wall Street. Analysts are focusing on tomorrow's meeting of Federal Reserve policymakers in Washington. The Fed is not expected to make a change in interest rates. The government's latest report on industrial production shows the output of the nation's mines and factories increased slightly last month, but some sectors of the economy were clearly doing better than others. NPR's Jack Spear explains.
The smaller-than-expected rise in industrial production last month follows a much bigger gain the previous month. Utilities and mines both boosted production, but manufacturing output fell. Much of the decline in manufacturing was a result of a drop-off in production of so-called big-ticket items, things like automobiles. Production of autos and auto parts was down 2.6% in August. That was partly due to the power outage that hit key production states in the Northeast, as well as the result of the industry's annual model year changeovers. The weaker-than-expected gain in industrial production is one more sign manufacturing, one of the harder-hit areas of the economy, may be still trying to find its footing. Factories last month were running at 74.6% of capacity, unchanged from the previous month. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
The United Auto Workers Union has reached a tentative contract agreement with Chrysler. The union's president says although a strike deadline has passed, existing contracts with General Motors and Ford will be extended while talks with those companies continue. Cincinnati's Chamber of Commerce wanted to honor the city's soap-making and pork business at an upcoming economic conference, so they commissioned an artist to carve a sculpture of a flying pig out of a block of 26,000 bars of ivory soap. Ivory is made by Cincinnati-based Procter & Gamble. The finished product has been named Sudsy. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, sponsor of Matters of Race, a new series by Roja Productions airing September 23rd and 24th on PBS. Local times may vary.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Is Israel planning to assassinate Palestinian President Yasser Arafat? Yesterday, the country's vice premier, Ehud Olmert, said killing him was an option. Later, Foreign Minister Sylvan Shalom said assassination was not official policy. Some say in Israel the peace process can't move forward unless Arafat's removed from the scene. Others fear making him a martyr would doom any hope for peace. Joining us now on the line from Tel Aviv is Alon Ben David. He's national security correspondent for Israel's Channel 10 TV. And hello, Alon.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Alon, how real is the possibility that Yasser Arafat could be assassinated by the Israelis? So after so much public talk about it in the past few days.
Well, as the foreign minister said, it is not a formal option, but it's certainly an option being discussed in many different forums and even in the cabinet. I mean, it was raised not only by the vice premier, Ehud Olmert, but also by defense minister and other officials. Even the biggest opponent to the expulsion of Arafat, the head of Israel's security agency, said that it would be better, if we're going to take any action against Arafat, it would be better to kill him rather than just expel him. So this is a discussion taking place in the Israeli society and in Israeli politics, and quite a, I'd say, a legitimate one.
Well, Alon, you have such a long experience in all this. You're Israeli. You have your finger on the pulse of the mood of the country. What do you think is going to happen here?
Well, I think that it might become a real formal option if something terrible occurs. Because right now, I think there is more fear that such a measure would create really disastrous effect. Even the head of military intelligence, a person that supports the expulsion of Arafat, saying that if Israel will kill Arafat, it will create another Jesus, that Jews will have to pay or take the blame for his killing for another 1,000 years. So I'm afraid that if something terrible happens, such as a major terror attack or anything like that, that would bring back this option to become a real one.
What kind of man is Ehud Olmert, former mayor of Jerusalem, now vice premier? He called it an option to assassinate Arafat. What does he represent? How important is it that he said that?
Well, I'd say he's a serious candidate for the post-Sharon to lead the Likud and maybe run for a prime minister's office. But he's mainstream Likud, I'd say, and he doesn't represent an extremely radical line.
Shouldn't the fact that giving Arafat so much prominence in the past few days has thrown him more on the world stage than he's been in a while, isn't that just a small, tiny indication of what would happen if he were turned into a martyr? Wouldn't people in the Sharon government be very worried about creating a Jesus, as you said?
Yeah, they are aware of that, and I think that the American administration was very clear in their objection to such measure, and certainly this kind of measure will be objected by everybody else in the world. But I mean, I think people in Israel are experiencing this this terrible war that is going on here for 3 years, and they really want to find a way out of this.
Yeah. Alon Ben-David, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Alon Ben-David joined us from Tel Aviv. He's national security correspondent for Israel's Channel 10 TV.
The goal was to simply get closer to creating a trade agreement, to come up with a blueprint. But even that was impossible. The World Trade Organization summit in Mexico collapsed abruptly yesterday when developing nations walked out, saying developed nations, such as the U.S. and much of Europe, were unwilling to cut farm subsidies. The developed countries said they would support their own farmers until developing nations, such as Brazil and India, reduced tariffs and opened up their markets. Well, the collapse opens the door for individual trade agreements. But what does that mean? Joining us from Cancun, Mexico, is Christian Science Monitor reporter Gretchen Peters. And Gretchen, first, can you place this meeting in some kind of context for us?
This is the latest series of meetings in what is called the Doha Round, launched almost 2 years ago in Doha, Qatar. WTO delegates agreed to phase out most agricultural export subsidies and eliminate most tariffs, but failed to set a deadline or specify which goods would be affected. The Cancun talks were considered the make-or-break moment to really decide these issues. And we saw the emergence of the so-called Group of 21, which joined almost two dozen developing nations, including, as you mentioned, Brazil, China, and India, which really lined up a new battleground that pitted the rich world against the poor.
Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of pessimism going into these talks about, you know, whether concessions would be made, but nobody, I don't think, predicted a complete breakdown.
There were more predictions going into the talks that they would be extended, that the talks would continue for several more days here in Cancun. So this really does create a bit of a quandary for the WTO. We don't see people sounding the death toll for the WTO, but similar to the UN, as we recently saw with the war in Iraq, many are questioning its relevance. Mm. I think the EU Trade Commissioner, Pascal Lamy, put it best when he said, "I wouldn't say the Doha Round is dead, but it certainly is in intensive care." Delegates are going to go back to Geneva, continue to meet on these issues, and they have until December 15th to try to come up with a solution that will move this process forward and make the WTO relevant again.
And in the meantime, what would these individual trade agreements mean?
We are going to see governments pushing for more bilateral trade pacts, more NAFTAs, more ASEANs, and that may serve to help the WTO down the line. The way the Group of 21 has emerged, they've put aside their differences among themselves and to come in as a new trade bloc. Similarly, Europe came to this WTO conference as a bloc. We may see the world dividing itself into more subgroupings in order to address trade issues more simply.
What does this mean for U.S. businesses?
I think the U.S. will suffer the least from this. The U.S. is still the world's biggest market. Everyone wants to do business with the United States. So for U.S. consumers and industries, I think it's business as usual.
Well, Gretchen, thank you.
Thank you.
Gretchen Peters reports for the Christian Science Monitor. She spoke to us from Cancun, Mexico.
2 weeks ago, it was unthinkable, but it now seems that Dick Grasso may go. As the chairman of the New York Stock Exchange, Grasso has overseen a decade of spectacular growth of the exchange and of his own pay packet. It emerged last week that Grasso was due to be paid $187 million this year, his $2.5 million salary, plus a huge lump sum. A sum that surprised even the Stock Exchange Board of Directors, which approves his pay. Now, under pressure last week, Grasso agreed to give up some of that cash, but it may not be enough. Reports today say the board is reconsidering Dick Grasso's future. We're joined now by Kate Kelly of the Wall Street Journal. Welcome, Kate.
Nice to be here.
Kate, first of all, break down this huge pay package for us, if you would. It isn't a simple matter of salary or even just a cash bonus, right?
That's correct. It's got a number of different components. the significant amount that folks had a strong reaction to when it was initially released in late August was the $140 million retirement payout. Essentially, that's a combination of things. It's money that he had in a savings account. It is a large portion of deferred compensation. So you can see how with $40 and $50 million chunks, that would add up to quite a bit as it sat accruing interest. So that was kind of the initial payout, and that is separate from his annual compensation, which over the years has been as high as $25.6 million. Then last week, there were further disclosures that he was actually due an additional $48 million.
Now, who does Dick Grasso work for?
It's actually a very complicated question. Dick Grasso wears two hats. On the one hand, he's a regulator. The New York Stock Exchange has a large securities regulator that Dick is essentially the head of. At the same time, he runs this marketplace, which controls about 80% of the market share in stocks listed on the New York Stock Exchange. So he does both of those things. He has equity shareholders who own what are known as exchange seats, and it's essentially a combination of individuals and their firms. And the seats give folks the right to do business at the exchange. They also give people the right to vote on exchange matters. But, of course, Dick also has to work with investors who need to be able to trust the exchange and feel as though it's a safe place to make transactions. And he also has to answer ultimately to his own board.
The average person out there is not paying any money to Dick Grasso. There's no public funds going at him, are there?
No, it's not fair to say that investors are paying Dick's salary in any direct way.
So here's the $147 million question, however you want to phrase it. If he's doing a good job, why shouldn't he be able to be paid whatever the heck the people who pay him want to pay him? What's the outrage?
I think the outrage is folks, particularly who work on the floor, the seat holders that we mentioned, just feel the number is too darn high. These people, many of them are small business owners who have been really hurt by the bear market, which has sort of squeezed their margins, mm-hmm. in effect. And on top of it all, they discover that their chairman is making a relatively large compensation package that's certainly much larger than what's collected by top regulators such as Bill Donaldson, chairman of the SEC, or Alan Greenspan. So they feel as though somehow they were misled, and that's contributing to this sense of outrage.
Kate Kelly is a staff reporter with The Wall Street Journal in New York. Thanks.
Thank you.
And this note, mission accomplished. After 14 years in space and 34 orbits around Jupiter, the Galileo spacecraft will soon meet its end. Galileo has been shut down and will fly behind Jupiter and plunge into the planet's atmosphere this weekend. Kelly Beatty is executive editor of Sky and Telescope magazine. And Mr. Beatty, why would scientists take a $1.5 billion spacecraft and crash it?
What they're afraid is that if Galileo were to become derelict and unable to be controlled, that it would crash into Europa, which is one of the places in the solar system that may have some life. And so we don't want to contaminate it unintentionally.
Yeah. And remind us, what did Galileo do?
Oh, many, many things. Jupiter's a complex place with moons and rings. It mostly will be remembered for Io, its volcanic moon. We've discovered more than 100 volcanoes and hotspots on Io that are erupting almost all the time.
How will it meet its end? I mean, how fast will it crash? What will happen?
It's going to be sent into the atmosphere of Jupiter at about 30 miles per second, and what will happen, it will literally kind of melt away and become part of Jupiter.
Yeah, you know, there's an odd sentence that jumps out from one of your magazine's articles months ago, talking about this coming up, that Galileo would continue to send data, but scientists decided not to look at it. You know, it has a somewhat poignant image of this little spacecraft out there still beeping in, but unfortunately just past its prime.
Well, the problem is that NASA has too many spacecraft to fund all of them, and it was one of those hard budgetary decisions that they had to disband the team to save money for other things down the road.
Mm. Well, we hear that the NASA scientists who work on Galileo, which, by the way, the number went from 300 to 30, but some are going to gather to watch this last moment as it goes behind Jupiter. And you?
I'm unfortunately not going to be party to that. I'll be just kind of quietly remembering all those wonderful accomplishments in my own way.
Mm. Well, Kelly, thank you.
All right. My pleasure, Robin.
Kelly Beatty, executive editor of Sky and Telescope magazine.
J. Just ahead, New York Times columnist Paul Krugman. The economy's basic math, he says, just doesn't add up.
And later, the Washington Week in preview and a review of HBO's K Street.
There's more coming up here and now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
For more than a generation now, cutting taxes has been a crusade, the clarion call of a certain stripe of American politician or pundit. But how much has the tax cut talk really cut taxes for most people? And what are the tax cut evangelists really up to? New York Times columnist and Princeton economics professor Paul Krugman had a piece on all this in yesterday's New York Times Sunday magazine. He's author of the new book, The Great Unraveling, Losing Our Way in the New Century. And welcome, Paul Krugman.
Good to be on.
When you want an economy to grow, why wouldn't it almost always be a good idea to cut taxes, put more money in people's pockets so that they can spend it?
Oh, if the only question was how to get out of our current parlous economic state, then you would want some combination of tax cuts and spending increases to pump purchasing power in. But if you look at what's actually happened, very little of the tax cuts that have been pushed under Bush are actually targeted on the current economic slowdown. They're following a bait-and-switch strategy. They're selling you these tax cuts as an answer to the recession, but what they're really doing is pushing in long-term tax cuts that do relatively little for the economy now but cripple the government's finances in the long run.
How have the taxes of average people, Paul, gone down in the past generation or so?
They're roughly level. If you look at people near the middle, the typical American family, they pay a little bit less in income taxes, a little bit more in payroll taxes, and state and local taxes have, by and large, roughly kept pace with income. So if you're looking at an ordinary family, it pays something like 26-27% of income in all taxes. The big changes have all been at the top. If you're making more than $1 million a year, then you're paying the lowest taxes that people in that class paid since Herbert Hoover was president.
Shouldn't the people, the rich, who pay most taxes get the biggest tax cuts?
If you look at the tax cuts, they are way disproportionate even to that. The share of total taxes being paid by the wealthiest 1% is going way down under Bush.
Paul Krugman, you have a term in your Sunday Times magazine piece, lucky duckies. What is that?
Okay. I didn't make up the term. The Wall Street Journal, in campaigning against tax breaks for low-income people, referred to people who are earning only $12,000 a year or $15,000 a year as lucky duckies because they pay little or no income tax.
Huh.
And said that this is bad because we want them people to have their blood boiling with rage against the federal government. There's this amazing theory on the right that while they're all for tax cuts for the rich, they're actually for keeping taxes as high as possible on the working poor because their theory is that if people pay taxes and don't get much in services, they'll hate the government, which will provide the political base for cutting taxes on the rich even more.
Wealthy campaign contributors, you write, have a lot to gain from lower taxes, and since they aren't very likely to depend on Medicare, Social Security, or Medicaid, they won't suffer if the beast, the government, gets starved. Now, that sounds like an extremely cynical approach to governing. It's saying essentially that Republican administrations, particularly who want to cut taxes, are just doing it as a sop to wealthy campaign contributors. Is that how this country works?
It's a fair bit of how this country works. I think if you were to look at the people who are pushing for ever more tax cuts, you'd find that the core is absolutely that cynical. There are some people who actually believe the stuff about how tax cuts will lead to incredible economic growth and pay for themselves.
Supply-siders.
The serious people, serious economists even on the right, regard those people with contempt, but it does pull some people in. And they're useful. You might say they're useful idiots from the point of view of the people who just want to downsize the government.
Do they understand, Paul, at the top of the Bush administration, what you refer to as the fiscal gap, yawning down the road not too far? The government simply, it's simple mathematics, won't be able to provide the Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid funds for the baby boomers because they won't be taking in enough revenue because taxes are too low.
That's right. We basically are now at a point where the federal government is taking in 25% or so less revenue, even adjusting for economic recovery if it ever comes and all of that. It's taking at least 25% too little revenue to provide the existing programs that it pays for. Now, does the staff of the Treasury Department understand this? Yes. Does the staff of the Office of Management and Budget understand it? Oh, yes. Does George Bush understand it? That's highly questionable. But he doesn't have to. He just needs to know that this is what his people want, and he'll worry about the rest after 2004.
Paul Krugman, 40% cuts in Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, when the baby boomers hit in 8 or 10 years or so. That's what you're predicting.
Well, that's by the arithmetic, that's what it would take to be able to balance the budget, which we must eventually do one way or another, at current levels of taxes.
Now, with these enormous deficits that we're talking about, at least in the next year or two, approaching $500 billion.
Passing half a trillion. No,
passing half a trillion, yeah. Where's it all going? What's going to happen here?
Well, we're going to have a crack-up of some kind. And it's hard to tell what kind. One of three things has to happen. We do in Argentina and actually go bankrupt. We roll back all of the Bush tax cuts and then some, because that's what it would take to close the fiscal gap. Or we drastically slash Social Security and Medicare, which is the only way to make room for those tax cuts. And if you ask about any one of those, people will say, well, that's impossible. That can't happen. It's politically inconceivable. And yet one of those three things has to happen. So my guess is that we will do a half Argentina, that we'll get close enough to a financial crisis that it will scare the hell out of us, and also wreak quite a lot of havoc on the economy. And at that point, we will face a titanic battle about whether it's going to be raise taxes or eliminate the legacy of Franklin Roosevelt.
5 years down the road? 10 years down the road?
As soon as the bond market realizes that we're heading off a cliff.
Paul Krugman, thank you so much for joining us on Here and Now.
Thank you.
Paul Krugman is a columnist with the New York Times and author of the new book, The Great Unraveling, Losing Our Way in the New Century.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, Seattle voters will decide if espresso drinkers should pay an extra 10 cents a cup to pay for early education.
And the future of speech recognition. Will we soon be speaking back to our computers?
That's tomorrow. Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, our D.C. Roundtable previews the week ahead and offers a quick review of Howard Dean on the new HBO show K Street.
We got a call from Dean.
Dean.
Governor Dean.
Who wanted us to do debate prep.
Also, a reading list for hard times. Authors continue to look to the past, to great writers like James Agee, to illuminate the present.
A lot of people look to Let Us Now Praise Famous Men, you know, still, it was written in the 1940s, because they feel like they're grappling with those issues anew.
These stories, coming up, Here and Now.
I'm Dolores Handy. The United Nations Security Council holds an open meeting today on the situation in the Mideast amid mounting criticism of Israel's Security Cabinet's decision last week to remove Yasser Arafat. A statement yesterday by Israel's vice prime minister that killing Arafat is a possibility intensified Palestinian demand for speedy UN action. Israel's foreign minister Sylvan Shalom says no formal decision has been made to kill Arafat.
It's not an official policy of the Israeli government, and we don't speak about any killing. We didn't speak about it before, and we don't speak about it today. I think that Arafat, while he's here, there is no chance to have peace with the Palestinians.
Palestinians are calling on the UN to demand that Israel ensure Arafat's safety. Secretary of State Colin Powell says that Israel would incite rage among Muslims everywhere by exiling or executing Arafat. Powell is visiting in Iraq today, seeing firsthand evidence of the brutality of Saddam Hussein's ousted regime. He went to a massive gravesite where some 5,000 people died 15 years ago when Saddam Hussein's forces bombed them with cyanide gas. Elsewhere in Iraq, three masked gunmen ambushed and assassinated a police chief in the predominantly Sunni Muslim town of Qadiya. The three attackers opened fire with a machine gun, shot one of the tires of the chief's car, then approached the vehicle and shot him at least 25 times. This is according to the driver of the chief's car. And a U.S. soldier was killed in Iraq this morning, the victim of a rocket-propelled grenade attack. The soldier was from the 1st Armored Division. He is the 156th U.S. soldier killed in Iraq since President Bush declared major combat over in May. Hurricane Isabel is still churning in the Atlantic on a westward course, expected to bring it ashore along the eastern seaboard later this week, possibly as early as Thursday. Computer models show Isabel is a powerful Category 4 storm and will likely strike somewhere between North Carolina and New Jersey. And 122 people are dead or missing, and $1.3 billion in damage is reported in South Korea's worst typhoon. Yesterday it battered the nation's main port and industrial southeastern coast. On Wall Street midday, stocks are lower. The Dow is down 25 points at 94.46.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Where to start after this weekend in politics? Bill Clinton impressed his party's faithful more than their candidates did. New polling shows 6 out of 10 Americans oppose President Bush's request for more money for Iraq. Vice President Dick Cheney, making a rare appearance on the Sunday morning talk shows, said he couldn't say it would be the last request. Meanwhile, Washington fact and fiction blurred in a new HBO mock documentary or as the New York Times called it, a cinema falsité, called K Street. Joining us on our weekly D.C. roundtable are Andrea Stone, congressional correspondent for USA Today. Hi, Andrea.
Hi, Robin.
And Carl Lubsdorf, Washington bureau chief for the Dallas Morning News. Welcome, Carl.
Glad to be with you, Robin.
Well, the weekend was jumping, but what about the week ahead? Congress will take up the president's $87 billion request. Do you think there'll be any surprises there, Carl?
Well, I think, you know, there's been a lot of focus on the opposition to it, and the administration spokespeople got beaten up pretty badly when they were up testifying. But Congress tends to support this sort of thing. And, you know, I was here all through the Vietnam period, and there was a lot of complaining, and then in the end they voted the money. And I suspect most or all of it's going to be voted.
Andrea, the two polls I mentioned were ABC News and the Washington Post, and they weren't good.
No. In fact, the Washington Post found that 60% disapprove of the request. I think from some of the talk last week, I was at a hearing with Paul Wolfowitz, Deputy Defense Secretary, and I think to a senator on both sides of the aisle, they were unanimous that they would give they would approve any amount of money for the troops in Iraq. They weren't going to quibble with the military part of that $87 billion bill. However, the $21 billion of that is for reconstruction of Iraq, they're going to go over that with a fine-tooth comb. I mean, the Democrats have said repeatedly, why are we building hospitals and schools in Iraq when we can't even do it here?
Well, and Republicans, members of his own party, have come forward. The isolationists have really been outspoken. And in the public, I'm noticing the conservative radio talk show hosts who jumped on the war bandwagon are now really quickly jumping off.
We know one of the biggest problems is the financial situation of the government, which is getting worse and worse. They've already admitted to a $400 to $450 billion deficit. This is going to make it even higher. Some people are talking $600 billion. And the Bush administration has taken the position that, you know, not to worry, everything is manageable. And sooner or later, there's going to be a day of reckoning. And I think I'd hate to be the next president, be he George Bush or a Democrat, who's going to have to deal with this.
I think we're seeing cracks already. Last week, the Republicans lost a few votes up on the Hill because some Republicans sensing that the White House was getting a little weak on the deficit and on Iraq.
Well, we'll have to see how that unfolds. But let's look at a past president. Bill Clinton stole the headlines at Senator Tom Harkin's annual steak fry in Iowa. We all can't still wrap our brains around fried steak, but nonetheless, they have it. And then also at the AME Church in South Central Los Angeles. What do you make of that for the Democratic Party, Andrea?
I think it's great for the Democratic Party, but there is the downside that he can't run for president again, according to the Constitution. So he does tend to overshadow the nine people who are running for president.
I watched the event in Iowa, Robin, and, you know, Clinton was at his, you know, near best, and he's certainly a far more compelling figure than the other candidates. But he's been a little careful, I think, about not to do too many of these things, because I think he realizes that.
Well, you say so charismatic, more so than Howard Dean.
Yes.
Yes.
Former Vermont Governor Howard Dean now seems to be the punching bag of choice for fellow Democrats running for office. We got an email from the Dick Gephardt campaign noting all of Dean's apparent flip-flops on NAFTA. So what do you make of that?
Well, it's, you know, he's got ahead in the polls, at least in Iowa and New Hampshire. He's not actually ahead in the national polls. And so they want to take him down a peg. He's a dangerous candidate, A, because he might get nominated, and they won't. But B, if he beats Gephardt in Iowa, Gephardt is in trouble. And if he beats Kerry in New Hampshire, Kerry's in trouble. Now, having said that, there seems to be a lot of areas where Governor Dean is vulnerable. He has said different things at different times. I was watching him on television yesterday. He was trying to explain to George Stephanopoulos on ABC that it wasn't true that he was a strong supporter of NAFTA. All he did was write a letter in behalf of NAFTA. Well, that kind of parsing of words is not going to fly. And you can see the commercials already with his head spinning back and forth. And so he's vulnerable on these things. Now, what will happen in the end? It's still too early to tell. It's 4 months till the Iowa caucuses.
Well, the dark horse in the Democratic race is former NATO commander Wesley Clark. Aides say he will announce maybe before Friday. What do you think, Andrea?
He's supposed to be in Iowa on Friday for a speech, and all of his aides say that he's going to make an announcement this week. Now, he has been very coy, even though he's been all over TV, saying he hasn't made a decision yet. But he better make his decision pretty quick, because it's already very late in the game. He's got to get money. He's got to get organization. And the biggest thing against him, besides the fact that he doesn't have any experience with elective politics, is that he is getting such a late start.
Carl, is he potentially positioning himself for VP?
Oh, that's what a lot of people say, and I'm sure that's, you know, in his mind. The fact is you can't really position yourself a VP. The candidate is picked by someone who will help the ticket or at least won't hurt it. But he's a potentially interesting candidate, partly because he'll take votes, if he gets any, from other candidates, and that could, with so many candidates, that could, you know, upset the balance.
Well, now, before we let you go, we have to comment on K Street, the Steven Soderbergh, George Clooney-produced drama about a fictional Washington lobbying firm which employs Democratic mouthpiece James Carville and his real-life wife, Republican Mary Madeline, and mixes these real people with actors at real events. Andrea, did you like it?
Not much. It was kind of, first of all, I can't imagine why anybody outside the Beltway would watch this thing. Second of all, it really was clear that there was no script. It was just all ad libs, and some of it not very good. And, you know, it was really confusing. I mean, I can see where there'd be a lot of buzz to it, especially given the scene where Carville and Paul Begala, Democratic consultant, are prepping Howard Dean for a real debate, and giving him Carville gives him a line that he actually used at the debate.
Well, let's listen to that scene. We have it. And this reminder, Howard Dean spoke all the words you're about to hear in the presidential debate last Tuesday. But in last night's K Street, you'll hear him first speaking, and then he's followed, coached by Carville.
Here's the biggest difference between me and all the other candidates on here that are white. I'm the only white person I've ever heard talk about race in front of white audiences.
You get the Vermont question. Say, look, if the percentage of black folks in your state was determined by your record on civil rights, then Trent Lott would be Martin Luther King.
So is that, did Carville feed that line to Dean, or did Dean give it? He did. Yeah. Well, that's not really the first time a candidate delivers a line that they didn't write.
Walter Mondale didn't invent the line, you know, where's the beef, when he put down Gary Hart with it. And, you know, that's what consultants do. I think the more problem with Governor Dean, frankly, is the fact that he's a little bit loose in what he says and is being called on it.
All right. Well, the jury's out on K Street and on the campaign, and so we'll check back with you on both of them. Thank you so much.
Okay.
Good.
Thanks.
Carl Lubsdorf, Washington Bureau Chief for the Dallas Morning News. Andrea Stone, Congressional Correspondent for USA Today, members of our Monday D.C. Roundtable.
Well, still to come, if you're out of work, you may feel you could write a book on unemployment. We'll check in on authors who already have. Literature of the Disenfranchised.
You're listening to Here and Now.
The Bush administration unveiled the Total Information Awareness Database last fall. The idea, to fight terrorism by maintaining detailed information on anyone of interest to the government. Well, MIT graduate student Ryan McKinley has since come up with an idea of his own. He's decided to watch the watchers by creating a website to do just that. He joins us now on the line to tell us about it. Welcome, Ryan.
Hello.
Ryan, how did you come up with the idea for your government information awareness website?
Well, the basic idea is that, given our current circumstances, we should really have the same tools available to citizens as the government has to watch the citizens. So it's essentially taking their model, saying, look, there's a lot of information out there. There's a lot of people that we need to connect to be able to share information. And saying, okay, that's fine, but it seems to make a lot more sense to have citizens participate to help construct a database about their government.
So what do you find when you go to the website? Is it a lot of analysis of what's going on at the moment?
At the moment, it links to sort of very straight biographical information, where people are from, university background, party affiliation, religious affiliation. So at the moment, it's all information that I've seeded. And this database will open up to public participation as soon as I get some more time to work on it.
What do you mean public participation?
So citizens can come to it with their own information. So if you happen to know which fraternities Tom DeLay was in, you would be able to enter that.
Now, what if you wanted to know something about Tom DeLay as your website stands now? What would you learn?
Right now, what you find out is very simple things, where he's from, campaign contributions.
What you've done is you've taken in a lot of information that was previously scattered across the Internet and kind of digested it, concentrated it into this one website.
Exactly.
So now you've got this big compilation of websites, everything from agribusiness websites to U.S. government websites, all these complex links in one place. But how will your website change, do you think, when regular people have access to it? Will it become one big blog?
The basic idea is that everything in there is annotated with who put the information in and where it came from. So you can set up filters to say, I only want to see information from these people, or I only want to trust information from these sources, which, you know, isn't that dissimilar from what we already do. When you watch, you know, certain news sources like, you know, Fox or read the New York Times, there's certainly different credibility that you give to things. And over time, you build up which sources, which contributors, which publishers you choose to trust more.
Yeah. Any reaction from the government or from politicians?
Actually, all the reaction has been incredibly positive. There's obviously some concern about what happens when it's opened up to, you know, anyone to contribute information, whether that's safe or not. That's obviously a complex argument that I look forward to seeing.
So the watchers are watching you watch them.
I'm sure they are.
Ryan McKinley, thanks very much.
No, thank you.
Ryan McKinley is the inventor of the Government Information Awareness website. For more information, go to our website, here-now.org.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
According to a recent Gallup poll, Americans continue to name the economy as the top problem facing the nation. Figures from August show that employers cut more jobs last month than they have since March, giving Americans even more fuel for their financial worries. Well, misery loves company. Or maybe not. Maybe what it needs is to curl up in a fetal position with a good book. The sorry state of our economy inspired Here and Now's literary correspondent Steve Almond to take a look at what he's calling the literature of the disenfranchised. And he's in the studio to tell us what he's found. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Robin. How are you?
Good. Literature of the disenfranchised.
I know. I hate the big multisyllabic words.
This isn't really a genre, so what brought you to this?
Well, Robin, as you know, I'm more often than not unemployed. So people who are out of work and having difficulty really just providing the basics is something that's close to me at most times. It's hovering on the horizon. As I was sort of looking around just in my day-to-day life, my friends kept losing their jobs, especially in the high-tech sector. More and more people were feeling a lot of economic insecurity. At the same time, I started reading a set of books that were really focused on an area that most Americans are not really interested in looking at. That is, people who are in a state of disenfranchisement. They haven't just lost their job and they'll get it back. They don't have the basic education and, in some ways, the sort of emotional and psychological and intellectual tools to be gainfully employed.
Well, and frankly, I mean, it's a terrible thing to say, but it makes for incredible storytelling because the protagonist, the one you're watching go through this, you know, meat grinder of job loss, it makes for a great subject.
Well, most good literature comes out of danger and difficulty and, you know, are being able to sort of vicariously experience those things. So I have to agree. I would say that I'm going to focus on recommending some nonfiction books, but I do want to mention that there are books like The Jungle, the Upton Sinclair novel, that focuses quite beautifully on, in this case, the meatpacking industry in the Midwest in the 1910s and 20s. So there's plenty of fiction. I'm going to actually focus on nonfiction because I was very drawn to, and I think people are when they think about subjects like this, they want the facts somehow. The first book I want to talk about is quite famous. It's called Let Us Now Praise Famous Men. It's a beautiful book by James Agee, a Southern writer, and it has photographs by Walker Evans. James Agee was assigned the task of going down to do basically ethnography down in the South and to report on the Southern sharecroppers, white sharecroppers predominantly, who are in a state of grinding poverty, a story not often told. The section I want to read is really his attempt to grapple with how you're supposed to write about a disenfranchised population. He writes, "It seems to me curious, not to say obscene and thoroughly terrifying, that it could occur to an association of human beings drawn together through need and chance and for profit into a company, an organ of journalism, to pry intimately into the lives of an undefended and appallingly damaged group of human beings, an ignorant and helpless rural family, for the purpose of parading the nakedness, disadvantage, and humiliation of these lives before another group of human beings in the name of science of, quote, honest journalism," whatever that paradox may mean. Now, that's an odd section, but it's really the second paragraph of his book, and it is attempting to grapple with the basic question you ask. You were saying, well, it's so compelling to read about people who are in this kind of trouble, but it inherently runs the risk of terrible exploitation. This is real misery, and A.G. was totally preoccupied with this question of, do I have a right to do this? A lot of people look to Let Us Now Praise Famous Men, you know, still, it was written in the 1940s, because they feel like they're grappling with those issues anew.
So, James Agee's Let Us Now Praise Famous Men, your first selection. You're next.
A book called Cold New World by a writer named William Finnegan. Finnegan is quite famous as a nonfiction writer. Mostly he writes about Africa. He's written several books about Africa, South Africa. He's an American, and he turned his attention about 10 years ago to American culture. And this is a series of four pieces that originally ran in The New Yorker that are about different populations that are very disenfranchised and quite terrifying. He writes about the crack epidemic in rural Texas, for instance, or a drug dealer in New Haven, a young teenage drug dealer in New Haven. His pieces are extremely straight reporting. He does very little editorial commenting and very little judging. I think he hears the echoes of AG saying, don't exploit these people, you know, don't talk down to them. The section I want to read is from a chapter or a story called The Unwanted. It's about kids in Antelope Valley in Southern California, where he actually grew up. And he's going to be writing here about a girl named Mindy, who's gotten involved with some skinheads. Debbie, Mindy's mother, remembered Mindy being deeply troubled by the idea that her dad had never been baptized and thought that was probably why Mindy later became a Mormon, because she wanted to be baptized herself. Actually, before Mindy became a Mormon, she had wanted to become Jewish. But that had turned out to be too much work. Becoming a Mormon was relatively easy. All this was before Mindy got addicted to crystal meth and became a Nazi in ninth grade. Now, that's a little slice of a very long piece that is attempting to capture how rootless these kids feel. None of their parents are safely employed, and so they get taken up with crystal meth addiction and a series of different ideologies. They're either Nazis or they're working against the skinhead Nazis. They want to find some other identity. And the fundamental problem is they are deeply insecure about how they're going to find work, how they're going to be able to find employment and a way to, you know, make a family.
Okay, so William Finnegan's Cold New World, about an aspect of unemployment you really don't think about a lot, the impact on younger members of the family.
Yep.
Okay, next.
A book that's actually called Random Family, that an excerpt also has run in numerous magazines. A reporter named Adrian LeBlanc essentially spent about 10 years, literally 10 years, interviewing and spending time with a group of families in the South Bronx. It's one of the most purest examples of immersion journalism I think I've ever read. This is not a book to read if you are not feeling like you can bear a certain amount of grimness, because these families are all in terrible shape. Most of the girls have many kids by several different fathers. Most of the fathers are in prison. There's a lot of crime, there's a lot of violence, and there's a really terrible effect on the kids. I'm just going to read a little section about Jessica, who's one of the central figures in the book. Jessica was good at attracting boys, but less good at holding on to them. She fell in love hard and fast. She desperately wanted to be somebody's real girlfriend, but she always ended up the other girl, the mistress, the one they saw on the down low, the girl nobody claimed. Boys called up to her window after they dropped off their main girls, the steady ones they referred to as wives. Jessica still had her fun, but her fun was somebody else's trouble, and for a wild girl at the dangerous age, the trouble could get big. And of course, it does get big. She gets pregnant, she gets it mixed up in the drug trade. What's fascinating about this book, much like Finnegan's, is that it makes absolutely no attempt to sort of psychoanalyze or understand the characters. It's very much a piece of pure ethnography that just traces these lives as they spin out of control. And all of this stuff is grim to look at, but it is the reality that we're in America. These books help people understand, essentially, what's going on in the inner cities and the exurbias of the country.
Before we let you go, Steve, there are all of those, as you mentioned, high-tech workers sitting there loosening their white collars and, you know, really sweating out being jobless. A read for them.
Well, I would ask probably that they take a look at the Arthur Miller play, Death of a Salesman. That deals with not exactly white collar, but at least pink collar economic insecurity and the tolls it takes on a family. And also a wonderful book called Revolutionary Road by the great Richard Yates, which is the first novel, supposedly, of sort of suburban anime. But I really think a lot of it is driven by a kind of creeping economic insecurity that's less overt than in these books, but is still always there under the surface, causing tension and eventually tragedy.
Mm-hmm. And we're well aware that given the nature of unemployment, this might be a great service you've just done in telling some people books to avoid because they just can't do it right now.
Not a beach read, absolutely.
Right. Steve, thank you.
Thank you.
Here now is literary correspondent Steve Ahman. He's also the author of a book of short stories called My Life in Heavy Metal. For more information on Steve's literature of the disenfranchised, go to our website, here-now.org.
You've got to cry a little, sigh a little. Well, and sometimes you've got to lie a little. Oh, life is like that. Well, that's what you've got to do.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
Our production team includes Andrea Shea, Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Alan Cockle, Karen Millard-Medson, Lindsay Crudell, Emiko Tamagawa, and Stefano Katsonis. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna.
Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Tim Skog and Boris Strapachki. Our web producer is Zach Christo, and our interns are Ed Walters and Ann Stevenson.
The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
People, that's what you got to do.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Join us next time for the news and these stories Here and Now.
Seattle voters are deciding if espresso drinkers should pay an extra 10 cents a cup to pay for education.
And computers and the future of speech recognition. No more point and click, just talk.
That's Public Radio's Midday News Magazine, Here and Now.